Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency covered up murders of innocent civilians in Honduras carried out on orders of its agents. Who is being held to account? Also, Berta Cáceres, the environmental and LGBTQ activist, was assassinated in Honduras last year, and now her daughter has narrowly escaped a brutal attack. What's going on? Our guest is Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And with Trump's U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions now promising to scuttle progress made in reducing mass incarceration under the Obama administration and to increase the numbers of those incarcerated, we discuss the pioneering work of the Center for New Leadership in the area of socioeconomic, criminal, and juvenile justice policy. Our guest is Dr. Divine Pryor, the organization's executive director. And for our weekly Earth Watch, the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, Ann Peterman, joins us. We discuss the campaign against genetically engineered eucalyptus trees in the U.S. This, as the USDA closes their public comment period on GE trees. Ann's objections are shared by 250,000 signers of a petition against GE trees. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Donald Trump vowed to a friendly crowd in Warsaw, Poland, to fight the threats of terrorism and government bureaucracy and issued a challenge to Russia.
We urge Russia to cease its destabilizing activities in Ukraine and elsewhere, and its support for hostile regimes, including Syria and Iran, and to instead join the community of responsible nations in our fight against common enemies and in defense of civilization itself.
Trump is set to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the G20 conference, which he will attend in Hamburg, Germany. The Polish government had promised the White House that cheering crowds would greet Trump. To make good on the pledge, the ruling party and pro-government activists bussed in groups from the provinces to hear Trump's speech. Trump's attendance at the G20 meeting in Germany is sure to receive a more critical reception. Thousands of people have already been protesting in the streets. At an earlier press conference, Trump denounced North Korea for its recent intercontinental ballistic missile test, saying it is behaving in a very, very dangerous manner. Trump said something will have to be done about it. He spoke the day after the United Nations Security Council held an emergency meeting on the latest missile test. UN Ambassador Nikki Haley threatened the use of military force against North Korea.
Their actions are quickly closing off the possibility of a diplomatic solution. The United States is prepared to use the full range of our capabilities to defend ourselves and our allies. One of our capabilities lies with our considerable military forces. We will use them if we must.
The Chinese representative, speaking through a translator, criticized U.S. military exercises with South Korea and the deployment of the THAAD missile defense system, which China and Russia say threatens them.
China has always been firmly opposed to chaos and conflict on the peninsula. Military means must not be an option in this regard. The deployment of THAAD anti-missile system in Northeast Asia seriously undermines the strategic security interests of regional countries.
North Korea sees U.S. and South Korean military drills and the THAAD anti-missile defense deployment as provocations and threats to its security. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is juggling several plans for repealing the Affordable Care Act, including an amendment by conservative Texas Republican Ted Cruz that would allow insurance companies to sell what critics call junk plans that don't contain coverage for essential services such as maternity, mental health, or emergency room care. While protesters picketed outside, Cruz explained his proposal, which would let insurance companies sell stripped-down policies so long as they also offer at least one plan that complies with the current requirements of Obamacare. He spoke at a town hall meeting in Texas.
What I am pressing, Senate Republicans, let's focus on lowering premiums, and that's a win-win for everyone. There are a whole lot of people, for example, that don't necessarily need or want full comprehensive coverage of everything.
Critics say that would segment the insurance market, with younger, healthier people buying cheap policies and sick people buying comprehensive coverage with unaffordable premiums. Cruz hasn't made the specifics of his amendment public. McConnell reportedly has sent two versions of the Republican health care and tax cut legislation to the Congressional Budget Office for analysis, one with the Cruz proposal. But McConnell is likely to have trouble with moderates like Susan Collins of Maine, who told CNN she's been getting an earful from her constituents over the July 4th recess.
What I've been hearing the entire recess is people telling me to be strong, that they have a lot of concerns about the health care bill in the Senate. They want me to keep working on it, but they don't want me to support it in its current form.
A federal appeals court says immigrant children who cross the border without their parents have the right to a court hearing to challenge any decision to detain them instead of turning them over to family in the U.S. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that two laws passed by Congress did not end the right to a bond hearing for unaccompanied immigrant children detained by federal authorities. The Washington Hospital, where House Majority Whip Steve Scalise is recuperating from a gunshot wound, says he has been readmitted to the intensive care unit because of new infection concerns. Scalise and four other people were injured last month when a gunman opened fire on a Republican baseball practice in nearby Alexandria, Virginia. Scalise was struck in the hip, and the bullet tore into blood vessels, bones, and internal organs. He has undergone several surgeries. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, the USDA is considering the first ever genetically engineered forest trees that would be approved in the United States, stretching across seven southern states, millions of acres from coastal South Carolina to eastern Texas. Now, at the forefront of this battle against GE trees, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Ann Peterman, the executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, and co-founded the project in 2003. She's also the international coordinator of the campaign to stop GE trees, which she co-founded in 2014. And she is a founding board member of the Will Miller Social Justice Lecture Series. She has been involved in movements for forest protection and indigenous rights since the early 1990s. Ann Peterman, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Margaret.
Right. I'd like to say that also the Global Justice Ecology Project partners with us for our weekly Earth Minute. Those of you who listen to our Earth Minute, you will hear, recognize Ann Peterman's voice, and also we partner with them for the weekly Earth Watch. So, Ann, it was actually yesterday that ended the public comment period. Where are things at right now with the campaign?
Well, we've got some amazing news. We have well over a quarter of a million people who've signed on to tell the USDA in no uncertain terms that these genetically engineered eucalyptus trees must be completely rejected, that in no form can these be allowed to move forward. The grand total of comments at this point that we've calculated is over 270,000, so well over a quarter of a million people.
Wow.
Which is far and away the most that we've ever had by far sign on against GE trees. So the momentum is continuing to build. We've been working on this particular issue since 2010 or 2009 when ArborGen first proposed a large quantity of field trials out in the wild that comprised a quarter of a million trees. We sued them over that. Then the USDA came back in 2013 releasing the petition, an actual petition from the GE tree company saying we want to legalize the widespread distribution of these trees commercially, so not just field trials, but commercially. And at that time, we got 40,000 comments at the rate of about 10,000 to one. So four comments came in favor of the proposal versus 40,000 that were opposed. And now we've got 270,000. So we've vastly increased the number of people since then who've said no to this. And I think the fact that there have been these massive wildfires in Portugal and in Chile that started in genetically engineered eucalyptus, in conventional, non-genetically engineered eucalyptus plantations is, I think, a big warning for people and a big red flag about what the possible risks are if these plantations were developed across the U.S. South, which is already experiencing heat waves and droughts.
And you're quite right about Portugal. Last week, in fact, we had a guest who was based on the ground in Portugal, and we talked about the catastrophic wildfires. But what is the reason being given for developing these genetically engineered eucalyptus trees?
They like the eucalyptus trees because they are applicable over a wide range of uses. So, for example, right now across the region, they have a lot of loblolly pine plantations. But pines are a softwood, and so they really are good for pulp and paper and perhaps development of some liquid biofuels if they ever got that technology sorted out. But eucalyptus are a hardwood species, which means that they can use them for pulp and paper, they can use them for wood pellets, they can use them for burning, for biomass. You know, they can do all kinds of things with eucalyptus trees that they can't do with softwood pine plantations. So that means that they can, wherever the market blows, they can respond with their plantations. They don't have to wait for, if the pulp and paper market goes down, they don't have to worry about it because they'll just shift the eucalyptus trees to biomass production, for example.
Right. And, this idea, I recently saw a film about genetically engineered seeds and the impact, the devastating impact it has on the lives, the health of vulnerable populations. This particular film focused on children, and it was really scary, what happens. And of course, the farmers who are trying to farm organically, and then you have these, Franken seeds blowing over and contaminating their crops. So the idea now that this will be extended to trees, right, which is so important to our oxygen and to our evolution, as people tell us more about the fears of the impact of genetically engineered trees.
Yes, exactly. I mean, these trees are actually much more serious than annual crops. They're not edible, these trees that we're talking about, these forest trees, these eucalyptus, genetically engineered eucalyptus trees. But the thing about trees that differentiates them from crop plants is that these trees can grow for decades. And if these plantations are abandoned, which often happens when we're talking about lots and lots of small plots of eucalyptus plantations, which is what's happening in Portugal and led to the wildfires, and is the same thing that would happen across the U.S. South if these were approved, because we're talking about lots and lots of small landowners. We're not talking about, one big landowner that has a million acres of plantations, but thousands of landowners. So, of course, in that case, some of these plantations are going to become abandoned. And what that means is they can grow as long as they want. They can drift into national forests, because they're very invasive. All kinds of things can happen, and they become even more flammable. The older eucalyptus trees get, the more flammable they get. So, genetically engineered trees are contaminating, a contamination threat for more than just the year of an annual crop plant that, like corn, for example, but they can continue to contaminate through or invade throughout their lifetime, depending on what kind of tree we're talking about. They're also genetically engineering poplar trees, for example, which have native wild relatives in forests all over this continent. That could be a serious contamination threat if those GE poplars started spreading their seeds and pollen into forests, because it's irreversible. Once that cycle starts, there's no way to stop it. There's no way to pull those trees back. There's no way to contain that. And they spread their pollen much more over much greater distances than annual crop plants. So, trees can spread their pollen for hundreds of miles, whereas annual crop plants usually don't spread their pollen more than a few miles. So the contamination threat is extreme. And of course, we're talking about trees that interact with forest ecosystems, which themselves are highly complex, from the soil microorganisms to the insects, to the wildlife, to the birds, to the understory plants, et cetera. These are not sterile cornfields. These are biodiverse ecosystems that have very delicate and highly evolved relationships. And you put in a tree that has never been there before, in the case of eucalyptus, or has had its genetics changed, and there's absolutely no way to know what's going to happen in that ecosystem with those, foreign organisms. So, there's so many risks involved here that it's absolutely ridiculous that the USDA would consider pruning these trees.
Yeah, and Ann Peterman, does anybody really know the impact on the health of the animal kingdom, so to speak, as well as human beings, of genetically engineered trees? Because, there's eucalyptus trees, but we know that they're also developing other genetically engineered trees. Ann Peterman.
The health effects of these trees is really being completely ignored. I think it's kind of the industry just closing their eyes and closing their ears and hoping that question goes away. But certainly when we're talking about, let's say, a tree that's been engineered to be insect resistant or herbicide tolerant, there are great health risks involved. In the case of insect resistant trees, every single cell of the tree contains the insecticide, which means that includes the pollen. So when the pollen blows around, people inhale it, and that has health impacts, especially for people who are sensitive to pollen, but even for people who aren't. What are those health impacts? Well, that has not been adequately assessed, and it has not been independently studied. So that's a serious health risk. Then also the risk of herbicide-tolerant trees, where you're now dumping huge quantities of toxic chemicals on these plantations to knock out all of the competition trees or other understory plants. Obviously, this stuff gets into groundwater, it contaminates the water, and communities nearby drink that water, and there are all kinds of health impacts. We see that already in countries like Brazil and Chile, which have non-genetically engineered eucalyptus plantations and already suffer these kinds of consequences. Just because of the ground spraying of these herbicides that happens. So you could imagine if these herbicides are now being sprayed from the air in much larger quantities, that these health impacts will be much more serious.
Yeah, and Ann Peterman, this is, so alarming. So many of us are suffering from various respiratory illnesses. I know I certainly have. And, allergies and hay fever, children being impacted, older people being impacted, people literally dying from some of this. So to me, this is really an emergency, an environmental emergency here. And given the present administration that seems to care even less about the environment than previous administrations, what is there anything that our listeners can do right now besides being aware of it? Anything else they can do?
Absolutely. This is just the beginning. The end of the public comment period for this draft environmental impact statement just means that now the government takes all those comments and turns them into their final environmental impact statement, where they will make their final ruling as to what happens with these trees. But there's plenty of other opportunities for intervention, you know, that aren't through the official environmental impact statement avenues. And people can go to our website, which is, there's a stopgetrees.org website and a nogetrees.org website. Both of those have ways that you can get a hold of us, and we can plug you in to different things that are happening. There will be, you know, different actions being planned. There's letter writing campaigns. There's all kinds of things depending on people's level of ability and commitment to get involved. And, you know, this campaign is just going to continue to get stronger and more active, not less. This is just one more step along the way.
Well, Ann Peterman, thank you so much for all of your work and leadership on this particular issue, and also for partnering with us for our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. And our listeners should know that we link on the Sojourner Truth website at sotrueradio.org, we link to the website of the Global Justice Ecology Project. So that's another way of getting information. Ann Peterman, thank you, and all the best with this.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And now we turn our attention south of the border. It's been 8 years and counting since the democratically elected and left-leaning president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, was overthrown in a military coup, a coup propped up by the U.S. State Department that was headed by Hillary Clinton at the time. 124 environmental and land activists have been killed in Honduras since the 2009 coup. In the years since, the indigenous populations of Honduras, as well as the Garifuna, the Afro population in Honduras, and the LGBTQ community have all been under threat. And mega projects like dams, logging, taking hold of indigenous ancestral land, and many targeted killings of indigenous activists protesting this displacement and other human rights injustices. The most notable assassination is that of Berta Cáceres, an internationally known and award-winning indigenous and environmental activist, as well as an activist on LGBTQ issues. She was assassinated in March of 2016. And just last week, on June 30th, there was an attack on Berta's 26-year-old daughter, Bertha Zuniga Cáceres. Bertha, who has taken up her mother's activism and is now the new leader of the Civic Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, was able to escape. She was attacked by three men with machetes, according to the Guardian of the UK. They also threatened to rape her. And some indigenous community members who are not directly involved in land activism, like the Cáceres family, they have also been subjected to violence. 5 years ago, on May 11th, 2012, a helicopter machine gunner opened fire on a small passenger boat in the Mesquito indigenous community of Honduras. Four indigenous villagers were unjustly murdered, outright killed, including a pregnant woman and a 14-year-old boy. And the attack was at the hands of a U.S.-vetted Honduran police unit and agents from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, who were conducting a militarized operation against drug trafficking. Now, here to discuss all of this, we'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Alexander Main. Alex Main is Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He monitors economic and political developments in Latin America and the Caribbean and regularly engages with policymakers and civil society groups from around the region. He's also regularly interviewed by national and international media, and his analyses have been published in a variety of outlets, including the New York Times, Foreign Policy, the Los Angeles Times, The Hill, the Mode Diplomatique, and more. Prior to coming to D.C., Alex spent more than 6 years in South America working as a foreign policy analyst and international cooperation consultant. Alex, welcome.
Hi, Margaret. Great to be back on your show.
Alex, first, this is, I must say, likely not surprising to anybody that the DEA, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, is involved in, you know, killing or at least giving the orders to kill or training people who kill innocent civilians. But let's start out by telling our audience, what is the Central America Regional Security Initiative?
Well, sure. Really, if you want to trace its origins, it goes back to Plan Colombia, which, you know, was essentially started under Bill Clinton in the late 90s and was originally a counter-narcotics plan for Colombia, the biggest producer of cocaine in the world, and quickly became a counterinsurgency program as well. And the U.S. Poured something like $5 billion into it. And today it's touted as having been a great success and having led to peace in Colombia and so on. And the fact is it coincided with a period of intensified warfare and a great deal of displacements. Millions of people were displaced within Colombia. Millions more ended up in Ecuador and Venezuela. You had a great deal of paramilitary activity and lots of evidence that paramilitaries worked in tandem with the Colombian military that was supported by the U.S. At any rate, this Plan Colombia, which is wound down a little bit, it still exists, but it's less intense today in Colombia, but it's been to a great extent replicated, first in Mexico with the Merida Initiative, and within the Merida Initiative, which began in 2008. So just as George W. Bush's term was ending and Obama was coming in, within that you had a section that dealt with Central America, and particularly the Northern Triangle being Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, you know, that splintered off and became its own thing called the Central America Regional Security Initiative. And since 2008, between the money that was allocated through the Merida Initiative and now what we've seen through CARSI, the Central America Regional Security Initiative on its own, it's over $1.5 billion that the U.S. has put into mostly security funding, training and equipping security forces in this region. And it's coincided with a period of great violence, something that we saw also in Mexico when the Merida Initiative took off, and many, many reports of human rights abuses implicating security forces that are receiving support from the U.S. So that, in a nutshell, is.
Yeah, and I was interested in your reference to on the paramilitary forces. I was just reading a story of a family, a single mother, I think, with about five children, who was her family was threatened, and she had to leave everything and that same night, flee from Honduras, and wound up in Mexico. And perhaps this wasn't a paramilitary unit, but it has the same impact when you have immigrants then fleeing that kind of violence, in some ways backed by U.S. taxpayer money, then being arrested and deported right back to that violence. But in terms of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, I think that's what it stands for, who do they report to, the U.S. DEA? Who do they report to? Is it the State Department or what? I mean, who holds them accountable?
Well, that's a huge question. And I think what we've seen in this Inspector General review. So just to back up a little bit, you mentioned the killing that occurred of these four boat passengers in the Mosquitia back in 2012. And following that, there are a number of us that looked into this and found huge conflicting accounts between what the DEA and the State Department were saying about the incident. They were saying that the people that had been shot at in this passenger boat were linked to drug trafficking and had fired first, and that Honduran agents in the mission had simply fired back in self-defense. And they were also saying that the U.S. had minimal responsibility in all this because their agents from the DEA were simply providing a support and advisory role. And we had a very different account from people on the ground, and we did, you know, an in-depth report on this. We reported back to members of Congress that were very concerned, asked lots of questions of DEA and State Department, and were consistently fed, you know, this same version of events, you know, that really made the boat passengers responsible for their own deaths. But, you know, there was increasing pressure, and finally, the inspector generals of both the Department of Justice and the Department of State agreed to do a joint investigation of what had occurred and the U.S.'s role and its response to this incident. And it took them 3 years. So 2 years just to get this investigation rolling, and then 3 more years to actually get the final results of the investigation. And part of the reason it took so long, as we found out through an article in the New York Times, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice actually went to the New York Times and said, the DEA is not cooperating with our investigation. We're asking them for emails. We're asking them for documents. They're not giving us anything. And he had to sort of raise a big public uproar about it for the DEA finally to turn over documents. And it's very, very damning what the review shows. It shows that they knew all along that they were giving a false account to the public and to Congress, that in fact the U.S. agents were in charge of this operation. They were leading the operation. And more than that, they actually ordered the Honduran machine gunner on one of the helicopters to fire at the passenger boat. And I think it's worth mentioning that these helicopters equipped with machine guns belong to the State Department, which gives you a sense of how militarized, you know, even this sort of civilian agency supposedly dedicated to diplomacy has become. They provided these machine gun equipped helicopters for the mission, as well as the contracted pilots through the private contractor DIMECORP. So at any rate, this is, you know, they'd given a completely false line. They were responsible ultimately for the killings, and there was no evidence. They said there was, but there was no real evidence that the boat passengers had any links to drug trafficking or had opened fire or had weapons at all. In fact, all the evidence pointed simply to the agents, the counter-narcotics police agents, having opened fire on this boat completely unprovoked. So they'd been feeding a completely false story, and they would have gotten away with it had there not been so much congressional pressure that there'd been this inspector general review, and had the inspector general of the Department of Justice not gone to the New York Times and said, hey, they're not giving us the documents here, and we would never have found out you know, actually what the real facts were around this case.
Yeah, well, now, though, Alex, that the facts have come out and shows that the DEA was basically lying. I mean, I just call it for what it is, with withholding it. I mean, who has been held to account thus far on this, if anybody?
Well, this is sort of the enraging thing, I think, from the point of view of all those that have been trying to get some kind of justice around this incident, is that no one's being held accountable. And even with this Inspector General review having very clear findings, pointing to very clear responsibilities, in fact, you have a very senior official from the State Department, William Brownfield, who's the Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, which is sort of the drug war arm of the State Department. He played a big role as well in sort of setting up and following through with Plan Colombia in Colombia. So he's been sort of the drug war czar. He is shown to have actively resisted any kind of outside scrutiny of the DEA in this incident. You had even the U.S. ambassador to Honduras, Lisa Kubitsky. She was getting all sorts of questions about what had happened. She wasn't getting responses from the DEA. They weren't providing responses. She called on the State Department to launch an investigation. You had the Bureau of Diplomatic Security that launched an investigation and that asked the DEA for information and asked for access to the DEA agents that were on this mission. The DEA refused, and they were provided full support from William Brownfield, this senior official from the State Department. So, and there are other officials that are named in the report. It's you know, there's some very clear responsibilities here, and people clearly identified, and no one has done anything.
Yeah, nobody's been held to account so far. Alex, so unfortunately, we're going to need to wrap this up, but it just seems to me as though while the bureaucratic wheels are grinding along very slowly, either on purpose or because that's how it's done, people are continue to be attacked and killed. I mean, look at what happened to Berta Cáceres' daughter just very recently. But Alex, is there anything our listeners can do? People who are listening right now, what could they do? And I also understand that with the new administration, with the Trump administration, that they now want to shift. Are they shifting responsibility for the DEA and that whole operation to the Pentagon, I understand, from the State Department? Just quickly clear that one up.
Yeah, it's not clear yet where funding is going to go going forward. I doubt that the DEA is going to lose much funding. I think you're going to see more of the traditional development assistance from USAID that's going to lose funding. In exchange, I think you're going to have more security programs that are going to be run directly out of the Pentagon as opposed to the State Department, where there'll be even less transparency around those programs. But as far as what your listeners can do, I mean, there are, you know, a couple of concrete things. One is you have currently a bill that was recently introduced in the House of Representatives. It's the Berta Cáceres Act. It calls for full suspension of U.S. security funding to Honduras, since there are, you know, clear links between, you know, the security forces that the U.S. has been backing and the killing of Berta Cáceres and other activists. So that's one thing. They can support that and get, you know, their member of Congress to support that legislation. Another thing, we were mentioning CARCI and the huge amount of money that's been poured into that. It is an absolutely opaque system. And at the very, very least, we need to have a lot more information on where the money is going, to what security forces, and to what end, you know, in this kind of horrific drug war violence that we're seeing in Central America.
Right. And people who want more information, Alex, congrats on your op-ed authored by you and Annie Byrd that appeared in the opinion pages of the New York Times on July 2nd, I think that is. So people can go there to get more information. Alex Main, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. We are going to take a short station break. And when we return, we'll be joined by Dr. Divine Pryor, who is the executive director of the Center for New Leadership on Urban Solutions. We'll be talking about criminal justice and human rights, human justice, and more. Thank you. The song is Earth Mother by Robert Tree Cody. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, you can check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. Let's see, why don't we do the state of Oregon today? A shout out to our listeners in the state of Oregon. We are now going to turn our attention to a critical issue, getting even more critical, because Trump's U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he's now promising to scuttle much of the progress made in reducing mass incarceration under the Obama administration, and also not only to scuttle that, but to actually criminalize even more people, increase the numbers of people who are incarcerated. And I'd like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Dr. Divine Pryor, who's done pioneering work. He is with the Center for New Leadership on Urban Solutions. It's an independent activist human justice think tank. Formerly, they were based at Medgar Evers College and the City University of New York. Dr. Pryor is a social scientist with extensive knowledge and expertise in criminal justice, health, and social service fields. He's traveled extensively providing counsel and technical assistance on criminal justice issues to judges, correctional staff, other people involved in the system on that level, and also has developed trainings and workshops for professionals that address issues such as anti-gang initiatives, poverty, literacy, unemployment, housing, and healthcare. Dr. Divine Pryor, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much, Margaret. I really appreciate you having me on the air.
What we're going to do, Dr. Pryor, before we hear what you have to say, we're going to go to a clip on the Human Justice Initiative, which is part of the work of the Center for New Leadership on Urban Solutions. Let's go to that now.
Well, the criminal justice system largely focuses on an incarceration model and attempts to approach it through the lens of sentencing, incarceration, and release. Human justice focuses on the totality of the individual and, in my view, endeavors to prevent people from the community from being initially entangled in the spiral of the criminal justice system, which ultimately is destructive for them and for the community.
When I first got on probation, I had to, I think, sit at Rikers Island for like 3 weeks. It was about probably like 40 of us in there. It was crazy because the fighting every day, I wasn't like, I'm used to seeing like people fight, but I didn't think it was like a, we wake up and we fight. We go to sleep and then we fight. It was so messed up.
We live in a prison nation. The prisonization phenomenon has become so entrenched and so expansive that we can't escape it whichever way we go.
The criminal justice system is a system which has been in place for a very long time, and it is doing exactly what it was built and set to do, which is a tool to keep people oppressed. And it plays out in many aspects. Everything from folks in our community being fourth or fifth generation incarcerated. So that means that they was in prison, that their fathers was in prison, their grandfathers in the prisons, and their fathers in the prisons. The criminal justice system is not to deter anyone from committing crimes. If anything, it's in place to keep a revolving door from the prison system to the community.
Recidivism rate, the rate at which people return to prison, it's anywhere from 60% to 80%. New York City and state has been cited for being definitely on the higher end. In the juvenile justice system, we spend $388,000 a year to lock up a young person under the age of 16. So you're looking at an egregious amount of money that we invest on the system side, on the lockdown side, for a return that doesn't make any rational sense.
Now, Dr. Divine, I'm sure likely a number of our listeners are going to be saying, did I hear that right? $388,000 a year to incarcerate one person under the age of 16?
That's absolutely correct, Margaret. It's an astounding figure, and it's something that this country has been committed to for decades. Not even to mention the fact that most of us who are in the criminal justice slash human justice, environmental justice community understand that today's prison system is nothing more than the evolution of what was formerly the system of chattel slavery. And so when you find those individuals in prison happen to be the great-great-great-grandsons and great-great-great-granddaughters of former slaves, what you see is this continuum of oppression that black folks and poor folks and black and brown people have been under since this country was established many centuries ago.
Yeah, and just recognizing July 4th, and we know what Frederick Douglass had to say. Many of us, you know, really spoke for so many, even today, when he said that for many of us, you know, July 4th has a totally different meaning than for other people. And also the 13th Amendment clearly also not covering people who are incarcerated. So fundamentally, they don't even have those rights. But, and you know, looking again, following the money, this $388,000 a year, you could think of what could happen with that money. Looking at your statement on the Human Justice Campaign, you talk about solutions for socioeconomic equality. And I have long thought that there is a direct connection with impoverishment, with the lack of an income, and incarceration. And, you know, when we look at the fact that single mothers are the fastest growing population of people going to prison, they're not the majority, it's still men, right? But single mothers, you see the connection also with the poverty of mothers and the connection even with so many of their sons ending up in prison, if not themselves. Your comment on the socioeconomic connection to all of this.
Well, you know, we've learned a long time ago that there has been a very direct relationship between what's happening in poor communities and black and brown communities and the prison system. In fact, the prison system really is a manifestation of what's actually happening in the community. And our founder, the late Eddie Ellis, informed us and taught us that there are really no prison problems. There are really only community problems. And that as soon as we begin to resolve the issues in the communities where we live, then you automatically see the prison system begin to shrink and those problems begin to dissolve. In 1973, a group of men in the Greenhaven Correctional Facility, they created what was known as a seven neighborhood study. And basically these men are using pencil and paper, going around the prison and just talking to each other, realized that 75% of the individuals in New York State prisons came from seven neighborhoods in New York City. They realized that these seven neighborhoods really were the source from which many of these individuals were coming from. And this was the first time that there was a direct link made between what was happening in communities and prison. Now, these seven neighborhoods, and that's just in New York, but in any state, those seven neighborhoods take on different names, but the characteristics are the same. These are communities that have been historically neglected, who have failing public school systems, who have substandard housing, who have poor quality healthcare system, where there's overcrowding and high rates of unemployment. These are all the factors that have contributed to individuals finding themselves entangled in a criminal punishment system. And it's not coincidental. It's not accidental. It's a part of this continuous systematic assault on blackness, again, going all the way back to the founding of America up until today. So it has very, very serious implications with regard to what we need to do to resolve these issues, which is why this human justice agenda that we're moving, this campaign, is really about how do we begin to address the root causes of mass incarceration and mass arrest? How do we begin to build the muscle in our community and change the power dynamic in the way that others relate to us and the way we relate to each other? How do we begin to fully focus on those factors which we know are transformative in nature and will help us through our own empowerment begin to change the dynamics of how we live day by day in our communities and how others view us and interact with us? So this campaign is really a major campaign. We've been working on it for years. And I think what we recognize is that you can't legislate what's in a person's heart. You can write all the policy you want. You can change all the laws you want. But as long as people maintain the same kind of belief system, as long as people maintain the same kinds of attitudes and the same structures that have been in place for hundreds of years are kept in place, we will never begin to change the way we are being impacted by this system. So we are very, very passionate about this human justice initiative and so happy that you allowed us to share this with your listening audience.
Right. And, you know, Dr. Devine, I mean, it always amazes me that so little, particularly sadly in the mainstream media and even so many of the elected officials who really don't even like to mention the word poverty, but just the relationship between the devastation of the social safety net, the devastation of the welfare reform implemented by Bill Clinton, and the rise in homelessness, and the rise also in mass incarceration. I mean, that along with the you know, what they're doing in quote unquote the criminalization in relation to drugs. And I must say that to note the difference now with the opioid epidemic, not only, you know, prescription drugs, but also a heroin epidemic. Now people are talking about it as an illness, right? And how people should get all kinds of help. And then it was black folks and brown folks with crack and everything else. It was lock them up and throw away the key.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's a whole racial aspect to it that a lot of folks try to deny. But you know that black folks, white folks, poor folks have been overdosing in communities across the country for eons, and there's never been any attention made to it. In fact, the only attention that's been made is that we need to build more prisons and we need to lock up more people.
Right.
And they criminalized addiction, something that has been diagnosed by the Centers on Disease Control as a clinical disease, that addiction is a disease like any other disease, should be treated from a public health perspective. But when it came to black folks, that's not how it was dealt with. Now we have a reemergence of this opioid addiction, and we see it happening predominantly in white communities. Now there's a totally different approach. Now we must treat it with tender care. We must be compassionate. We must ensure that they have the appropriate treatment and so forth. So we see this kind of racialized approach to it, and we can't deny the racial implications behind it. But you pointed out something earlier very interesting, and that's, you know, women are the fastest growing segment of the prison population. And let me add to that, that it's women of color, not just women in general.
That's right.
Women of color, black women, mm-hmm. are the fastest growing segment, because they've already incarcerated so many of our men, and now they're working on our women.
That's
and
it.
I know, because I'm a black man coming from a black family, we know that the women are really the backbone of our families. They are the bedrock of our communities. They are the source of our strength, the one that introduces all of us to the world, teaches us how to walk and talk and how to perceive and interact with the world. Once you begin to attack our women, you're undermining the very substance of our humanity. You're going to the very essence of who we are as a people. So now this focus and this attack on black women now really raises the bar. And now the call for human justice now has to be heightened and illuminated, because now our very survival is at stake in a way that it has never been before.
Absolutely, an emergency. And you talk about human justice as a concept and practice. We need a lot more time so you could spell all of this out. But you are also, for our listeners in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles area, you are coming to Los Angeles and you're going to be honoring a good friend of this show, Danny Glover, and your Human Justice Awards 2017. Tell us quickly about that and where people could get information about this.
Well, absolutely. On July 22nd, we'll be celebrating.
And that's Danny's birthday.
That's his birthday, his 71st birthday celebration. Uh-huh. We'll be doing it in View Park, an extraordinary estate. And what we'll be doing, we'll be honoring him with the Human Justice Award. The first one was given in 2012 by Harry Belafonte to our founder, who's no longer with us. The second one will now be presented to Danny Glover. And it was initially going to be presented also by Harry Belafonte, but his health is not as strong as we'd like it to be. So instead, he's sending a special gift that's going to be opened up right at the ceremony. But we will be bringing together an exclusive circle, Alfre Woodard and Angela Bassett and Susan Sarandon, and just a whole host of celebrities will be there to celebrate with Danny the human justice campaign that we will launch. We'll be talking about the work that we're doing with Grid Alternatives, which is a Los Angeles-based new energy, clean energy company that's really expanding workforce development, particularly for people who are disadvantaged, those who are coming out of prison, and those who are underemployed. We're joining forces with them, as well as partnering with the Los Angeles Mayor's Office to bring this new beginnings, new entry program to the Los Angeles area through our human justice model, something that we are so proud about and that we'll be replicating across the country.
Okay.
And if there's anyone interested in this particular event, they can reach us by simply emailing krhee@centerfornewleadership.org. And new leadership is spelled N-U, not N-E-W.
Right.
So that's krhee@centerfornewleadership.org.
Right, and we actually have information. We're posting information on the event and where people could get information on our social media. We're going to have you back and learn a bit more about the programs that you're doing, the Bed-Stuy Human Justice Initiative, the work that you're doing in Los Angeles and other places. And we thank you so very much, Dr. Divine Pryor, for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Okay, we are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern, Sherelle Withers, assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and Kiana Turner, our engineer for today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.